from the Sky News Centre at 5. In the last hour, a 16-year-old who stabbed his former friend to death after a Snapchat row has been jailed for at least 15 years. Abdul Rahman Ali from Tottenham in North London sent laughing emojis on the app after Osman Sharif Sufi, also 16, claimed he was the toughest. Ali then stabbed Osman in the chest with a 31-centimetre knife in June last year and has now been convicted of murder. The teenage driver of a stolen car who crashed, killing five people, has been sentenced to 4.5 years in detention. The vehicle crashed when it hit a tree in Leeds in November. The 15-year-old previously admitted causing death by dangerous driving. Elise Dare's brother, Darnell Hart, was among the victims.
We have to live with the sight of seeing my little brother through a window with his face smashed in. 4 years, it's not even a year, but alive, he'll be out in 2 years' time.
A gang who planned to make and supply fake ID documents has been jailed for a total of more than 16 years. The group of seven, who were based in London and the Midlands, charged people up to £900 for fake passports. It helped people to live and work illegally in the UK. The Brexit secretary insists he, the Prime Minister and the Chancellor all agree on what they want the outcome to be when the UK leaves the EU.
There is no difference between the Chancellor and myself, and indeed the Prime Minister, in terms of that we both want a Brexit which serves the British economy and serves the British people.
David Davis has been laying out his vision for what he's calling the bridging period immediately after Britain's departure. Donald Trump has used a speech to world leaders to say how nasty and fake he thinks the media can be. The president also told the audience in Switzerland the US economy is strong and his country is open for business. And Tesco has announced plans to stop selling energy drinks to under 16s. It follows in the footsteps of other supermarkets, including Aldi and Asda. That's the latest. I'm Laura Safe.
On BCFM 93.2.
This is Bristol. It's Friday, 5 o'clock. Welcome to the Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news is MP for Bristol West Thangham, Debonair. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is off sick, bless him. So we're joined by former Sunday Times Rich List journalist and author of Who Owns Britain, Kevin Cahill. A few little good wishes and prayers for Martin. I'm sure we'll go amiss. And his mum was a vicar, so that might help. You never know. And hopefully he'll be back with you next week. But I won't, because I'm off for 6 weeks. After the 6 o'clock news, why is Julian Assange still imprisoned in the Ecuadorian embassy, even though there were no charges against him from Sweden? And now the Swedish authorities have said they don't want to interview him. Plus our usual tour around the world at the hotspots, but getting away with it. 26 councillors in Devon are Freemasons, and there's no obligation on any of them to declare their membership, so there may well be more. Why are so many more councillors, and possibly MPs, Masons than the rest of the population? Are they there not to work for us, but to do favours for friends, like making sure their mates get planning permission? We'll be having a look at the history of Freemasonry and our present royal family, the Queen's strong but little-known connection with it, and go back to look at links to the Zionist movement creating the State of Israel, as well as possible origins. They say it all started in 1717, but there's evidence from pre-revolutionary France it all started actually in the English Civil War. Finally, why did the outgoing chairman of the Police Federation use his final speech last month to attack Freemasonry within the law enforcement system? It's all in the second hour, after six. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 5 Celsius and some light rain. This weekend, around about 11, temperatures up to around about 11 Celsius, cloudy and windy, but with rain tomorrow, Saturday, maybe a little bit clearer on Sunday. Next week, highs of 11 Celsius, cloudy and windy, with showers and sunny spells through the week. Next weekend, 3rd and 4th of February. Highs around 7 Celsius, sunny spells and some light showers. That's next weekend. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Now, just to warn you, this show has been moved by the station manager, Pat Hart, to a slot an hour later from next week onwards. So from 2 weeks' time, from next week, we'll be starting at 6 and finishing at 8. I realise that means listeners who watch local West Country or Points West TV news, when we finish our news slot at 6, will no longer be able to do that. I might be wrong. I think Hard News Current Affairs does have a place in prime time 5 to 6 drive slot, but I've not been asked for my opinion. The boss has made his mind up, and after all, he is the boss. Next week's show and the foreseeable future will start at 6 and end at 8. By coincidence, yes, a real coincidence for a change, I'm off on holiday and leaving you in the capable hands of the Saturday edition arts show's Billy Quain for the first 3 weeks, and for the last, it'll be the incorrigible Steve Satan. That's for the last 3 weeks. They'll be getting the politics show settled into its new hour later time slot when I return, inshallah, mid-March. So, helping us review this week's news, it's the MP for Bristol West Thangham, Debonair. Hi, Thangham. Welcome to the politics show.
Hi, it's lovely to be back.
Hello. Now, what's your basic situation at Westminster at the moment? Is there still this kind of infighting going on in the Labour Party, or are you managing to concentrate on attacking the Tories rather than attacking each other, which was happening for quite a while, wasn't it?
No, we've never stopped attacking the Tories, and we're still attacking the Tories, and we've been attacking them all week and all last week and all the previous week as well.
So what issues at the moment? What is coming up for you? Because I know one of the most important things an MP does, and hey, out there, folks, if you've got problems and you're finding that the system isn't working for you, it's always worth dropping a letter to your MP. I don't want to make more work for you, but you have this thing called casework, don't you? So what's the sort of highest amount of, or maybe you could just go through some of the things you've been doing for casework recently?
Casework, which is where individual people have problems that they come to me for their help about. It's usually when lots of other things have happened and they've not quite worked out. And the largest amount is about immigration and asylum. That's mostly refugees. But also about, there's housing queries. There's things where people are getting stuck by, you know, for instance, small business owners getting stuck with difficult high business rates. We've got things where people are coming in with problems that they've had with their health, where maybe the health's getting better, but they'd like health policy to change. So some of it's about policy. But my constituency work is, you know, constituency surgery and casework is just one small part of it. It's a very important part of it. Today, for instance, I was at Cabot Primary School first thing in the morning, talking with a reading group, the school council, and giving a school assembly. Then I met with the chief fire officer to be briefed by him. I was speaking at the Holocaust Memorial Day event. I did policy surgery this afternoon. I got casework surgery tomorrow. And I'm holding a public meeting on Brexit tomorrow afternoon.
Right. Whereabouts is that? Maybe people might want to come along.
It's up in White Ladies Road. If you go to my website, debonair.co.uk, you can get more details.
The Holocaust Memorial, I always think that's a bit controversial there, because the Holocaust is talked about as what happened to the Jews under Hitler and Nazi Germany. But actually, the Brits have been responsible for some Holocaust through history. Would you agree with that?
Yes, but the focus of today is about memorial of all Holocausts. So I was speaking about the importance of words, and that's this year's theme for Holocaust Memorial Day. And actually, Holocaust Educational Trust talks about all sorts of different Holocausts, but there has to be a focus on the murder of 6 million Jews by the Nazis, because that is one of the biggest and most cataclysmic Holocaust that we've known. And I think that's really important, because it's still in living people's memory.
Well, you say that because it's in our memory, yeah. But I mean, the number of Native Americans is now estimated in North and South America, something like 100 million slaughtered.
And we need to talk about those too.
I mean, that's hundreds of years ago. But it's important history.
Yes.
And we're now seeing, actually, in the city centre here, the unveiling of a whole new centre next to the opposite St Mary on the Quay Church, right in the middle there with the War Memorial. But Edward Colston's still right in the centre, isn't he?
Yeah, and there's a lot of controversy about that, and particularly about, for instance, the naming of Colston Hall, and should we change its name. I personally think it's time that we did change the name of the Colston Hall, but we still need to think about the fact we've got Colston Street, Colston Avenue and Colston Primary School. So it won't get rid of the name Colston. Actually, I think that's part of Memorial too, is that we actually need to remember the people who did things that have harmed other people and large scale. And I think that's important as well. But whether we should put statues up to them, I think that is up for question. Well, and calling big halls after them, I think it's time we moved on from the Colston Hall.
A statue of Colston, yeah. Maybe with some of the people that he was responsible for slaughtering, effectively. I mean, so many people were actually just thrown overboard, weren't they, on the slave ships?
And I, you know, like I said, I think it's time we moved on from having statues just just devoted to Colston, but I'm also pretty pleased with the fact that we've got a statue of one of the early Indian political resistance movement, the Indian political thinkers, who's right outside the City Hall. I think, as I said, I think we should change the name of the Colston Hall. Personally, I would like to change it to Causton Hall after Gene Causton.
The Indian Mutiny, are you talking about that? Because actually, isn't your family from India?
Originally? Yes, I wasn't talking about the Indian Mutiny. I was talking about the Indian Resistance, which is slightly different. Yeah, my family's from India. My dad came over from India on the boat. He's from South India. He was from Madras. He came over in 59.
Should I assume your family are Hindus and you're from a Hindu part of the country? Because we assume, don't we, that Pakistan was Muslim and India was Hindu.
Yeah, and yet India is actually a secular country. It hasn't got a state religion. It's one of the things I love about India is it's a secular country and it's a pluralist country. My family are a family from the 23 million Christians that there are in India. So my family is South Indian Christian, and that's actually it's a thing.
I didn't even know there were Indian Christians. That's amazing. I mean, I suppose that was something that was just happening over the centuries, just like it was everywhere else. These different religions are spreading around.
Yes, and they have their own format. In fact, in Madras, we have something called St. Thomas Mount, because St. Thomas was supposed to have sailed and arrived in Madras in order to spread the gospel in the early centuries. So after Christ. So, Christianity has actually been in India almost as long as it's been in this country. It wasn't something that was exported by the British colonialists, although lots of other stuff was.
I wonder what you make of the whole sort of colonial legacy, though, in India. I mean, I hear anecdotally, I've never been there, but from people that come back and they say, oh, a lot of the elderly people say, oh, when the British were here, it was wonderful. But obviously, that doesn't really fit with what was really going on, which was just colonial exploitation.
Well, I think it's more complicated than that, because actually some of the exploitation that was taking place was done by Indian Rajas, and I think that needs to be taken account as well. It was not a straightforward, simple relationship. I know some of my elderly aunts who said, yes, the British ran the place well, but they still wanted the British to go home. They still wanted India to run Indians to run India. However, India is a complicated country. And when I tell people, my Indian relatives, that I'm a member of parliament, they're quite often sort of baffled that, for instance, I don't arrive in a chauffeured car with a load of security, and that I walk to the station in the morning to get to work, and I just bicycle around the constituency. So people see politicians, for instance, in a very different light, and not in a good light. And there's an awful lot of people who think that the powerful in India have now become very, very corrupt. Now, I'm not saying whether or not I agree, because I don't live there the whole time, but certainly that's a very popular view.
Another view, also popular, is that India is a corrupt country and Britain is not.
I don't know. Who said that?
Well, look, I mean, for example, Transparency International.
Yeah, they rate Britain. Yeah, they rate India as more corrupt than England.
Yeah,
than Britain.
I mean, do you think that's true or not?
Well, I know that there are incredibly strict rules about what money I am allowed to take and the limits that I'm allowed to spend in an election, for instance. There's no such limits in India. And so my cousins have told me about Indian elections where politicians come around with TVs and radios. I'm not allowed to do that. And I'd get found out if I tried. And I would go to prison. We have really strict rules on election expenses. We have really strict rules.
Hang on, because in 2015, the Conservatives actually overspent in quite a lot of marginal constituencies.
Yeah, the police
and
investigated.
And they didn't go to prison. None of them did.
Well, some of those investigations are
some
still live.
Some might call that corruption.
You might say that. I couldn't possibly comment. But they did get investigated, and I think that's really important, that whether or not the election rules were stuck to or not, they were investigated. And I would be investigated. My opponents would be on me like a ton of bricks if they thought I had issued a leaflet that was one penny piece over my election leaflet's limits.
Well, I suppose that's good, isn't it, actually?
Yeah, it is. It's a good thing. Yeah. And it's good that there's limits. It's good that there are strict rules. It's good that I have to declare every single penny. You can look it up. It's public record.
I'm going to just bring in Kevin for a minute, because I know, Kevin, yes, I announced at the beginning that you've written this book called Who Owns Britain. Mm-hmm. It's actually getting quite expensive now, because it was published, I think, about 2002 or something. And it was extremely well sought after. Last time I looked, it was £100 to buy secondhand. But you've also done something called Who Owns the World, haven't you?
Uh-huh.
And I'm not asking you to have an encyclopedic memory as to who owns India, but it would be interesting if there are still some powerful British families that have got, holdings and interests still in India post-colonial era. Because as I know, in many parts of the world, as the British moved out politically, they actually still owned a lot of land and that sort of thing.
Malaya. There's very little visible evidence of residual holdings, but there are bound to be some. But the biggest problem India has is inherited debt on land. It's one of the things that keeps India from ever getting anywhere. You know, that
you can acquire, you know, inherit a piece of land, but you also inherit debt going back centuries. And it's, what's it called? You're locked into the debt. But there's not much evidence of residual British landholdings in India.
Other parts of the world? Where they are?
Malaysia. A lot of the old rubber plantations are plantations. And there are some plantations in Assam that are owned by British companies or by British shareholders.
Because, I mean, we like to think, it's cosy and cuddly to think that the colonial era is over. But actually, financially, Britain is still a very powerful colonial country, isn't it?
Yeah, but also the Tata family, which is an Indian industrial family, owns a very large amount of this country's industrial base and across Europe. I mean, Tata, you see the name Tata everywhere. And that is an old Indian industrial family with a lot of power, owns a lot of tea plantations across India, but owns an awful lot of our industrial base too now.
Okay, well, let's go back to Prime Minister's questions earlier this week and have a listen to, because of course one of the big problems over the holiday has, and after the holiday too, has been difficulties in the National Health Service with emergency doctors getting extremely irate with the Health Secretary Jeremy Hunt about the state of affairs in accident and emergencies right across the country.
Mr. Speaker, the Prime Minister must be aware of ambulances backed up in hospital car parks with nurses treating patients in the back of ambulances, ambulance drivers and paramedics desperate to get on to deal with the next patient can't leave because the patient they're dealing with at that moment can't get into the A&E department. It's been reported that a man froze to death waiting 16 hours for an ambulance. Last week, a gentleman called Chris wrote to me saying, my friend's 93-year-old father waited 4 hours for an ambulance after a fall. These are not isolated cases. These are common parlance all over the country. It needs money, it needs support, and it needs it now. Prime Minister is frankly in denial about the state of the NHS. Even the absent Foreign Secretary recognises it, but the Prime Minister isn't listening. People using the NHS can see from their own experience it's being starved of resources. People are dying unnecessarily in the back of ambulances and in hospital corridors. GP numbers are down, nurses are leaving. The NHS is in crisis. Mr. Speaker, Tory MPs might not like it, but I ask this question of the Prime Minister. When is she going to face up to the reality and take action to save the NHS from death by a thousand cuts?
There is only one part of the NHS that has been cut, seen a cut in its funding. It's the NHS in Wales under a Labour government. This is a government that is backing the NHS plan, that is putting more money into the NHS, that is recruiting more doctors and nurses, that is seeing new treatments come on board which ensure that people are getting the best treatment that they need. Because this is a government that recognises the priorities of the British people. Priorities to ensure that our NHS remains a world-class healthcare system, indeed the best healthcare system in the world. Priorities to build the homes that people need, to make sure that our kids are in good schools. This is a government that is building a country that works for everyone, and a country in which people can look to the future with optimism and hope.
So, I mean, that was really interesting, because what Jeremy was doing was quite rightly hammering the Prime Minister on their record on the health service. Doctors are saying it's in crisis. Ambulance workers are telling me it's in crisis. People who work in management are telling me of the struggles that they're having to make all of the budgets go round. And what the Secretary of State for Health, Jeremy Hunt, and what the Prime Minister keep doing is saying we're spending more than ever. What they're not getting is that we've got an increasing population, increasing elderly population, and they're not spending the right money in the right places or enough money. Because actually what we've had is a real terms cut in many parts of the health service. We've had they promised parity of esteem for mental health. We haven't seen that. They promised that they would take on winter crises. Each winter we lurch from crisis to crisis. And what hospitals tell me is that it's no use doling out a bit of emergency money on the 1st of January. It's too late by then. We need proper strategic, proper funding of the NHS to make sure that it is still free at the point of use.
Now, at question time last week, one of the members of the audience said what you're doing is you're actually starving it of resources deliberately. so that you can privatise it? Is that?
I mean, it's certainly a hypothesis that I think has got a lot of merit, to be honest, because I do think sometimes, why are they doing this? What possible purpose could it serve? And that's certainly one conclusion that you can draw. I mean, we held, as opposition, I mean, we don't just hammer the government on PMQs. We hammer them at health secretary questions. We had an opposition day debate devoted to the NHS week before last, at which we were absolutely, I think, nailing the arguments and making sure that Jeremy Hunt understood that we are not letting him off the hook. We're going to expose him for everything that he's doing.
Well, you can expose him, yeah, but you can't actually change anything.
Not until we get elected as a government, and obviously that's one of the things that I think we need to do. It's the only thing that is seriously going to change the fate of the NHS, I believe. But public pressure can also, and political pressure and public pressure between them can sometimes stop bad governments from making the worst decisions, but it isn't going to change the overall direction until we have a Labour government.
Kevin, what do you make of this allegation? And it's rather disappointing, isn't it, that you have to get people in the audience coming out with these points rather than the panellists. One wonders where the BBC get them from every week. The NHS is being set up to fail at the moment.
Yeah, well, I mean, we live in a part of Exeter where there are a lot of doctors and people living around us. Sorry, excuse me. And Theresa May standing up and saying those things, it's like listening to somebody screaming in a gale. You know, she's in denial. She's on the wrong planet. All the ordinary people, but social media and everything is full of ordinary cases, ordinary people who can't get treatment, have to wait 10 weeks for an appointment and all this sort of stuff. I don't know what Theresa May thinks she's doing by making these statements, because they make no sense to ordinary people out there trying to get appointments.
Well, I can tell you what the Conservatives will tell you is that it's because we're having to get the deficit down, and that was another thing that came up at Prime Minister's Questions this week.
Maggie Throop.
I want the latest figures from the Office of National Statistics, which show that the government is making further progress in reducing the deficit. Would my right honourable friend agree it would be reckless to change course now in favour of a policy of renationalisation, which would burden taxpayers like those in Erewash with an estimated bill of over £170 billion?
Yeah. Prime Minister!
My honourable friend raises a very important point. It hasn't been easy reducing the deficit in the way we have. We had to deal with the biggest deficit in our peacetime history that was left us by the Labour Party, but by the government's decisions from the government. Yes. Yes. Labour may not like hearing that, but it's what happened. It is by the hard work of the British people and by decisions that the government has taken that we've been able to reduce that deficit. But £170 billion extra, in order to meet the ideological desires of the Leader of the Opposition, would saddle people up and down this country with higher debt, and ordinary people would pay the price.
It makes me so angry. I'm sorry, because what she's doing is she's making an ideological argument, and she's accusing the Labour Party of making an ideological argument, and she's neglecting to notice the fact, or even mention the fact, that deficit, which is day-to-day spending, may have come down, but debt has gone up. They are borrowing more than ever, and they are pretending like this is not happening. Now, a policy of deficit reduction is actually hurting the country. It's hurting ordinary working people. It's kept people on static pay for the last 7-8 years. Public sector workers haven't had a pay rise in years. She's also saying that it was a mess left by the left Labour government. It was a banking crisis, and it was a global banking crisis. And the last Labour government was actually managing to turn the corner before we were kicked out of office in 2010.
But
so it
she's
makes me
saying
furious.
Your ideal of nationalising all these utilities is going to cost £170 billion.
Yeah, it's extraordinary, isn't it?
Because
I don't know where they get that figure from. Because, for instance, let's take rail, which is a massive support for taking rail back into public ownership, and rightly so, and I'm on record as having supported this for many years. And the reason it's a good idea is because it doesn't have to cost us any money, because we currently license out railways to private companies, and we are paying twice, because we're giving them subsidies and then we're paying as passengers. We're also paying a third time in terms of cancelled trains and late trains and overcrowded trains.
You know what, actually, one of the things that I've noticed since it was in the 1990s, wasn't it? It was privatised, is you're now really squashed in. There's only a very few seats where you can actually sit with a table and sit with your friends and chat. Actually, the trains from Bristol to London have completely changed from relaxing, warm and comfortable to you feel like you're in a cattle wagon.
Yeah, and if you travel on trains in Europe and you'll go to sort of a country like, say, Germany or the Netherlands, where the trains are publicly owned, and you can see the difference. You actually get reliable trains. People in Germany and the Netherlands get really annoyed if their trains are anything like 3 or 4 minutes late. We just accept it as normal. And we accept crowded, dirty, late trains, and we're paying through the nose for it. We should bring them back into public ownership. The minute we get into government as a Labour Party, we are going to do just that. And Jeremy's made that commitment. We're all absolutely behind him on that.
Even if it costs £170
billion? Well, the thing is, it isn't going to cost £170 billion, is it? All we have to do is wait for the franchises to be up, and then we just take them back into public ownership. And we know that from the East Coast Railway, which was publicly owned when its previous private company just dumped it because it couldn't make a profit on it. Fine, don't make a profit on it. The state was running it perfectly competently, and then the Tory party, completely ideologically, decided to sell it off again, and now they're back in the struggles. So in the private sector, it needs to be back in public ownership. How we do it, that needs to be discussed. I think there's a lot of people who say, I don't really want to go back to the great old days of British Rail, one monolithic, great big state organisation. I actually think it might be better done by local authorities. But I'm up for any sort of options there. And I just think that it's time we stop being ripped off by private train companies.
Well, and also, of course, in electricity and gas and energy sector. Yeah. One of the things that I looked at recently was that if you've got lots of money and you invest your £20,000 or so in electricity or gas shares, you never pay a bill again. And in fact, at the end of 20 years or whatever of having those shares, because you're getting the dividends from the shares, which are basically paying your gas and electricity bill, and you see your investment go up as well. So effectively, for anybody who's wealthy, they never have to pay anything for their gas and electricity.
Which is just outrageous, isn't it? Because they're called utilities for a reason. They're essential. You know, we need gas, electricity, water, and in order to live our lives. And in order to do this, we are being ripped off again by high prices, but also the energy companies, which should be investing in the renewable energies of the future so that we can sustain ourselves long into the future, and so we're tackling our carbon emission reductions properly, that's not happening adequately either.
But
so
these
we're messed up each way.
Are talked about as far left communist style ideas,
but there's also been
some changes in the Labour Party this week, with some changes to the National Executive, and this was with a group called Momentum, who have seemed to have gained more influence within the senior ranks of the party. And that, combined with the previous question about nationalisation, came up at BBC Boro time, I call it, question time, because most of it's boring, but you usually get one little bit, and this was it, I think, from last night's BBC question time.
I'd like to ask the Labour MP, if your party is so big and so powerful and coming forward, how come the best you've got to offer is Jeremy Corbyn?
In my humble opinion, Jeremy Corbyn is the best leader that the Labour Party has ever produced and will be the greatest Prime Minister this country has ever seen. Because it will have a reforming agenda that will make this country work for ordinary people, eradicate poverty and have an economy that actually gives people a stake in society and a decent future, decent pensions, decent public services. What is there not to like about that?
I can remember... Sorry. I can remember what it was like when the Labour Party left office in 2010. Debt, bills no paid, and notes to say, good luck, Conservative, there's no money left. I'm old enough to remember what it was like when the public utilities in the 70s were in mostly Labour's hands. Strike after strike after all out, and everything. That intercity, you want to talk about trains? Intercity? Jeez, you've got a short memory,
right,
sir. You've got a short memory.
But the Conservatives have doubled that.
All right. I'll take one more point. Man up there at the back. You said the back. And then we go on. Yes.
Utilities are actually state-owned. The energy market is owned by the French government mainly. The railways are owned by the Dutch and German government. And the Royal Mail is partly owned by the German government. So they are state-owned. It's just not Great Britain who owns them.
Okay.
got it spot on. And we, you know, I've already referred to the fact that some people are uncomfortable about having recreating what we had in the 70s. We need to recreate a modern, publicly owned railway service for the 21st century. But they, you know, had it spot on. The German government and the Dutch government do already own chunks of our railway service, and the French government own a chunk of our electricity service. I mean, it just makes no sense to me that we're arguing about this as though it's an extremist idea. I think an awful lot of the public support us. I know that the polling definitely supports us on railways, and for all I know, probably on the fuel and water as well. Certainly most people I speak to in Bristol West don't understand why we can't, why we still are paying through the nose for these terrible services that are privately owned.
Well, one of the things that's been privatised is a lot of the maintenance of hospitals, schools, big government construction contracts. We don't really know what's gone on here in Britain, but certainly in Spain, the big construction contracts for the last 20 years or so that have been contracted out by the People's Party, which was originally Franco's party over in Spain, there's been massive bungs coming from those big construction companies in Spain into bank accounts controlled by the party in Switzerland. And so this is what happens, it seems. And one of the things that's one of the areas in Britain that is controlling this is Carillion. Now, last week, Carillion collapsed. Now, what does that, do you think, effect is that having on our schools and hospitals?
It's not good. I mean, you know, it's wider than our schools and hospitals, though. So at the moment, the government is saying that they're going to honour the contracts of people working on the public sector contracts. Now, I think that's yet to be seen, to be honest. We haven't seen that actually happening yet. And the Labour Party's been hammering the government on this. But what's not been mentioned is actually all the private sector contracts. So the people, ordinary working people who are going to work as builders, as plumbers, and all sorts of jobs that they're doing through no fault of their own. Their company has gone bust and they don't know where their jobs have gone. And apprenticeships. So we've got a Carillion apprentice centre down in the Feeder Road in the centre of Bristol, which I've visited. There's a load of apprentices who don't know anymore whether or not they're going to have a future which they had planned. And this is what happens when you get a company set up that's run on contracts that they have overbid for, when they're over leveraged, when they're actually incompetent. There were loads of warning signs, which again, Rebecca Long-Bailey, who's our Shadow Business and Energy and Industrial Strategy Secretary, she hammered Greg Clark about this week. I know I keep saying hammering, Tony, but it is important. The Labour Party are absolutely showing up that the Tory failure here. There were warning signs and warning signs and warning signs, and they ignored them and carried on handing out public sector contracts.
One of the stories in The Guardian this week is about borrowing and debt. It's saying that UK insolvencies are at the highest level since 2008. Personal debt has risen to £1.6 trillion as a record number of households turned to bankruptcy deals. A number of people who went bankrupt in 2017 soared to the highest level since the aftermath of the financial crisis, according to official figures.
And it's only going to get worse with the collapse of Carillion, because thousands and thousands of small businesses were involved in the supply chain or in subcontracts, and they do not know where they're going next, because their banks are being outrageously uncooperative with them and the government isn't helping.
It seems like the whole of society is being starved of funds, Thangham.
Yes, it does. And that's why hearing Maggie Throop and Theresa May go on about bringing the deficit down just puts the anger in me, because it's where's the benefit going from all of this? Who's actually benefiting? Certainly not public sector workers who are not getting a pay rise, and private sector workers who tell me that they're facing real difficulties in their pay and conditions as well. You know, I don't know where all this supposed good stuff is going, but it certainly isn't going to my constituents.
Again, in The Guardian yesterday, 7 in 10 UK workers are chronically broke, study finds. God, this is depressing,
yeah,
isn't
it's
it?
Really depressing.
It's really annoying,
yeah,
and depressing, you know, because this doesn't need to be like this.
No, it doesn't.
Economic insecurity is the new normal, with only 30% saying that they live comfortably. Economic insecurity has become the new normal in the UK. 70% of the UK's working population say they're chronically broke, according to a study by the think tank Royal Society of the Arts.
And it worries me that we've got a whole generation now, the younger generation, who've grown up assuming that they're going to pay swinging rents, that they'll probably never be able to buy their own home, but they're really struggling even to rent their own home. They're not able to get on the council waiting list. They're not paid well. They haven't had any experience of what decent pay and conditions actually feels like. which means that they are much more vulnerable to being exploited by employers. And even if they've gone to university and got qualifications, they're still coming out and not getting jobs that are using their skills. And that really worries me, because that is our future. That's the future taxpayers to fund all the public services we need. But also, they are literally the future, in that most of us who are as middle-aged as me, in my mid-50s, you know, what we want is for the young generation to feel hope. Now,
so,
I do think there is hope.
Hang on. Yeah. Where are you going to get the money from?
So, I mean, we've got two key things which we were really clear about in the last general election. The Tories have cut taxes for the richest, and they've cut corporation taxes for the biggest businesses. We would reverse those taxes. That would not affect anyone.
Those companies are just going to leave Britain, aren't they?
No, well, they see.
They're going to go and move to Holland or something.
Yeah, but there's no evidence to show that, because actually there are companies, there are countries and in Europe that have got higher tax rates than us for corporation tax and personal tax and have managed. There are ways of doing this. And we've said really clearly that nobody who earns less than 80,000 will be paying more in tax. Now, I think that's a pretty high threshold. And most of the people I know who want decent schools, decent public services, they want decent hospitals. And most people are willing to at least think about funding those properly.
Now, one of the biggest problems we've got at the moment is... Sorry, do you want to come in there, Kevin?
Yeah, no. When I did some tax work for Gordon Brown, and he made me a wonderful promise. He said... When this was before Labour came into government first, he said when Labour got in government, he would turn the tax havens back into holiday resorts. And he tried. He did not break his word. He tried. And the biggest obstacle he met was the United States government, who wouldn't let him change anything. We wound up with the same tax dodgers here at the end of Gordon Brown's period as Prime Minister, as we'd had under the Tories. Don't talk about raising taxes. All you have to do is say that any corporation which bases itself in a tax haven pays normal British tax. You don't need complex legislation or anything. But Gordon did find himself opposed at the time by the United States government, so he couldn't get the status of
havens. I think I've spotted a little tiny flaw in your argument there, because actually some of the biggest tax havens in the world are controlled by Britain. They're crown dependencies, not by America.
I wrote the list in the book. I focused very strongly on this.
What about the Channel Islands?
You know, I mean, right next door. In Devon, they're about 20 miles away.
So how do the Americans, how can the Americans tell us that, you know, that so you can't stop the Channel Islands being a tax haven?
I'm not 100% sure, but it might have something to do with $100 billion debt from World War I, which we still owe the Americans.
One of the problems as well here, Thangam, is that the European Union this week have just announced that they are not going to sanction several of the tax havens in Europe. They've let them off the hook, effectively, because they've sent letters to the European Commission promising that they're going to change. Well, we've heard this before, but places like Liechtenstein are no longer on the blacklist in Europe as tax havens. So, you know, it's not just Britain, it's the EU as well that's guilty of this.
If I could come in, if you get back in government, and I believe you will, the first thing you do is just make that single paragraph change. If you're registered in a tax haven, you pay British tax. And we produce a schedule of tax havens, and we don't negotiate with them. We just say, if your company is registered in Jersey, we'll treat you as domestic.
But you know what they'll do? They'll just take their money out of that tax haven and they'll put it in a different one.
Another British one. Cayman Islands?
Well, no.
Anybody?
Maybe Liechtenstein. That's not British.
No, but I'm saying you schedule all the...
But that's why...
This is a domestic approach to the problem. You just ignore and you say, here's a list of tax havens. If your company trades in those, we... tax you as though you were domestic.
You'd have to put some sort of exchange control barrier
I think
up
you would.
First, wouldn't you?
Well, no, I think what you need to do is have better cooperation with your international partners. You know, I mean, that does raise the problem of if we don't get cooperation from the Americans, but cooperation from the Europeans, we have now reduced our influence on other European countries. So that's what we need to do, is to make sure that we are introducing rules at the same time as other countries are introducing similar rules.
But we're just leaving Europe.
I know, and that's a bad idea.
What's he called? The president of the Commission?
Juncker,
the world's biggest organiser of tax dodging, and we've done nothing about him.
And we're leaving all of that because we want less influence with them, not more. Yeah. I think that's a big, big, big mistake. Because what we do is we leave Europe with all its flaws. We have less influence, not more. And that
we're already suffering.
Thank you. I wonder, are you worried about what's going to happen with Brexit?
Yes, very. Extremely. A lot. I mean, for instance, I met this week with the creative industries. And if you imagine, if you are a band at the moment and you want to tour around Europe, you have no forms to fill in. There are no rules. You just get on a bus with your instruments and your equipment and you can gig anywhere in Europe.
But you're not going to need a visa or something.
How do you know that, Tony?
Well,
you did before. You used to. Why do you say it's very unlikely? I think it's extremely likely.
I don't know if I ever had to get a
you
visa.
Did, you did.
To
you used to. Yes, you absolutely did. I was a musician and I was a member of the Musicians Union. Okay. And I know plenty of colleagues who you had to get a visa. You had to go and fill in forms. You had to declare customs declarations at every border before we had the European Union
it's
and free movement
annoying,
of goods and services.
It's
going to be more than annoying. That's going to restrict people from making a living. But that's just musicians. I can give you loads of other examples.
But at the end of the day, if we don't get our hands on this tax haven money, this money that's been squirreled away in places like Panama, we're going to have more of this. And this is another thing that came up at Prime Minister's Questions this week.
Peter Allness.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. On 28th December, the East of England Ambulance Service attended an address in Lowestoft at which a man was sadly confirmed as having died. This followed on from a call the previous afternoon from the police regarding the same person who, it appears, was left outside overnight in what were inhospitable weather conditions. I've now spoken to the person who made the initial call to the emergency services, and I have serious concerns as to how the matter was handled, including why the case only came to light in the last few days. I would ask the Prime Minister to endorse the request that I've made to the East of England Ambulance Service and Suffolk Police to immediately instigate a full and independent inquiry to establish exactly what happened and to then put in place measures to ensure that such a tragic event does not happen again.
Prime Minister.
Can I share my honourable friend's concerns about this event, about what happened here, the tragedy that happened here? First of all, I think we should recognise that our ambulance services, all those who are delivering our ambulance services, work hard and regularly go above and beyond the call of duty to ensure our safety. But there have been concerns raised about the provision of services in the East of England Ambulance Service Trust, including, obviously, this very, very worrying and tragic case that my honourable friend has raised. As I said in response to the Leader of the Opposition earlier, we take these cases very seriously. Any claims that patient safety has been put at risk are taken seriously. And the Department of Health and Social Care has received assurances these reports are being investigated by the Trust as a serious incident in conjunction with its commissioners. This is also an issue that my honourable friend, the Minister of State for Health, has discussed with the Chief Executives of NHS England and NHS Improvement.
One of the other things I've noticed is that the government has fiercely resisted using its lawyers any attempts to actually get statistics for the number of people that have died because of the benefit cuts. Several stories just this week, Thangam, about the similar sorts of things. Pensioners found wandering the streets in tears in Swansea because she couldn't stand to stay in her freezing home. The issue of fuel poverty had been raised in a shocking incident in Swansea. Increasingly common plight of fuel poverty with the vulnerable freezing 71-year-old woman who was found by Recco Rees, Carl Casey and Carl Vickers, who were donating food items and clothing to the homeless in Swansea at the time. We were stood outside Primark when we spotted this woman walking with a frame. She was in tears and looked really upset, so we asked her if she wanted soup or hot chocolate, as we had a stove we were using to heat it up to give to those that needed it. She said she didn't want it. I asked her what she wanted and she said she needed clothes as she was freezing. We gave her a hat, gloves, scarf and some hoodies. She told us she was going to McDonald's to warm up and her flat was too cold to stay in.
Yeah, and this is just absolutely awful. And I think that's what makes me so upset with the attitude of the government and the complacency of the government, is that examples of fuel poverty and food poverty as well are, we bring them up week after week, not just at Prime Minister's Questions. I know you played some good clips in Prime Minister's Questions, but actually there are Secretary of State questions every day. So we're challenging the Department of Work and Pensions Secretary, you know, the Business and Energy Secretary, we're challenging the Health Secretary on all of these things. And the complacency of the government is such that what they will do is exactly what the Prime Minister did there, and blame anybody but themselves.
OK, another story. A homeless man died days after the council took his sleeping bag away. This is Tory-run Bournemouth Council responsible for this. A homeless man was found dead near the town hall. He had his sleeping bag taken away by a local council worker. A rough sleeper known only as Kev, he was 66 years old, was found dead under a flyover in a car park in Bournemouth, Dorset. The friend who discovered him said that just days earlier, people from Bournemouth Borough Council removed his sleeping bag and his possessions. Council has previously come under fire for playing bagpipe music to deter people from sleeping near the town's bus and railway stations and buying one-way tickets for rough sleepers to leave the town in any direction. An unnamed friend who had known Kev for 18 months said, "I put my hand on him to shake him, and that's when I knew something was wrong and my heart sank."
I mean, again, what you get there is the fact that the council are paying to ship homeless people out of their own responsibility. And that makes me very angry, because that's a question of just shipping out your problems and getting someone else to deal with them. And someone died as a result. It's just absolutely dreadful.
Well, we've had similar, at least threats here in Bristol. I don't know if it's been carried out, about people having their possessions taken away who are kind of wandering around. They've been evicted for whatever reason, and they've got maybe a few possessions, a shopping trolley or whatever, and the council is saying, well, if you come into the town, we're going to confiscate your belongings.
Yeah, and yet I've not actually come across actual evidence that that's happening. What I have seen, however, is that the charities that help street homeless people and other homeless people are doing an incredible job. That other organisations, including churches and community centres, have opened up their doors to help people, especially in the winter months. My office will always do what we can to help, as do the other MPs and councillors. And we are struggling for the fact that councils like Bournemouth will ship their street homeless people up to Bristol, and that we are then having to deal with even more people with dwindling resources.
Don't you think that the city council and the government are thinking, well, if we don't do it, maybe the charities will just pick up this work?
No, actually, I think that the city council are doing their best, and they're making, trying their best to make their resources go as far as possible. They are funding a lot of the street homeless work.
We've got something like 200 street homeless a night here in Bristol.
Yes, and that has gone up and up and up since the Tories took
power. So the council haven't really been doing that, have
No,
they
have. It's just that the number of people coming here from other cities has gone up, and the number of beds has been, you know, it's been difficult for charities to keep that up, but the city council are doing their best to support them on that. And yes, there are more people than ever, unfortunately, but I've been out on the soup run and the dawn tea run with people from the homeless charities, and I know that there are outreach workers going out there every single day to try and get those people off the streets and into a safe bed for the night, and it's not easy.
Another angle to this, which you don't often hear about, this is in The Guardian on Monday the 15th of January. "I knew I was in labour. Why are women being turned away from hospital during childbirth, as a number of women recount how they were mistakenly told to go home and wait before giving birth on the pavement or in a lift? Experts warn the more investment in labour care is needed." So this, I suppose, is a spin-off from the problems in the NHS, that people are just being told, no, you're not giving birth, go home and call us when you are.
Yeah, and again, I think that the problem here is that the Health Secretary and the Prime Minister just do not take responsibility for what they're doing to the health service. They're starving the health service of funds. People are living longer, they have more complex needs, and some of this is a good news story, that, you know, more of us than ever are surviving what were once deadly diseases such as cancer, but we then have further complex needs as a result, and the health service, the health secretary and the prime minister are not planning strategically for how we meet
those
needs.
But it seems we're moving towards a sort of survival of the fittest society, where people who are, you know, just not able to cope with life for whatever reason, whether that's a physical disability, a mental disability, not having enough money, are just simply left to die.
And that is not what I want. It's not what you want. And it's not what most of the people in Bristol that I meet want. And in fact, I don't know anybody in Bristol that I've ever spoken to who wants that. I think that we're trying our best in really difficult circumstances as a city to show that there is a different way.
A number of homeless people sleeping on the streets. This is a bigger picture, really. Looking back, the Joseph Rowntree Foundation do this every once in a while, bless them. A number of homeless people sleeping on the streets in England hits the highest level on record. More than 4,500 people were recorded as sleeping rough on any given night in autumn last year, a figure that's doubled since 2010, and they reckon that the actual figure, Thangam, is probably double that, because this is only the official amount.
Yeah, and I think they're probably right, and this points to a bigger systemic problem, though, doesn't it, Tony?
That's a lot, isn't it? We're talking about roughly 10,000 people across the country.
It is, and what we've got is a problem with very high rents in certain places, particularly in Bristol, but not only in Bristol. We've got a problem with the fact we haven't got enough social housing, which I know that Paul Smith, our lead councillor for housing, is trying his best to sort out, but it's difficult. we haven't had a systematic investment in publicly owned social housing by any recent government, and we need that now. And it's one of the things that we've committed to as a Labour Party that we would do in government. And I think it's important, Tony, because we are talking about very difficult, dark things that are happening at the moment. I want to give people hope. There is another way. And in my view, obviously, I would say this because I'm a Labour MP, but I know my colleagues and the members of the Labour Party and supporters of the Labour Party, we all believe in a different way. And my view, when I talk to the people out in Bristol West, which I do every weekend, whether there's an election or not, is that's what the people I represent want as well. We want a different way of doing things, and I think that time is coming.
At the other end of the scale to this, we've got something called Davos happening this week. It happens every year at this time of year. It's a super five-star resort in Switzerland where the rich and powerful of the world all get together, including your shadow chancellor, John McDonnell.
Is he there, is he? Yes, oh, I did not know that.
Yes.
Has he? Blimey.
Anyway.
I didn't know that.
But anyway, it was, I thought, a terrific piece in the Mirror by Kevin Maguire saying, Davos man is the diehard enemy of a fairer world and sustains grotesque inequality. Well, of course, top of the agenda at Davos is, oh, we need to address inequality, income inequality, which was actually amazing. But what do you make of these sorts of gatherings? Apparently it costs around about £500,000 for some of the corporate people to actually even attend this event.
I mean, I don't know what to make of those gatherings because the chance of me ever going to them are nil. But I do think that it's interesting that they should be discussing inequality, because actually income inequality is economically deeply inefficient. So even if you're an uber capitalist, which I am definitely not, you shouldn't want there to be income inequality, because actually that causes a drain on public services. Whether you fund them or not, there still is a drain. But also, there are people who aren't out there contributing to society because they're being left on the sidelines. Now, so it's really economically inefficient to have economic income inequality. People who are very poor really struggle to pay their rent, but also that means they haven't got any disposable income to pay on other things which help keep the economy turning over. So I'm not surprised that they're looking at economic inequality, income inequality, because there is a strong economic argument for it. But I am really interested to know what John was talking about to them. I hope what he was doing was getting them to see that the Labour government is no threat to world order. It's actually one of the greatest things that I hope is I'm going to see in my lifetime sometime soon.
Kevin, I'll ask you to say something about Davos in a second, but one of the things Kevin says, he says, I'm a pacifist with attitude and resolutely opposed to political violence. Though the World Economic Forum, to give Davos its formal title, reminds me of a quote attributed to George Orwell about how a bomb placed under the West Stand at Twickenham Rugby Ground in the 1930s would have set back British fascism by 50 years.
Yeah. No, I think John McDonald should be at Davos, because one of the things, we're stuck with capitalism in some form to make an economy work. And the best thing, if you like, socialists can do is understand how capitalism functions so they can tackle it properly. One of the great capitalists of our era, George Soros, describes a lot of current capitalism as bandit capitalism. In fact, our problem is we're not dealing with capitalism. And it's great that John is there, because he's going right in the heart of it and he can see how these people are doing it. Most of them are doing it through tax havens. That was when I did the Sunday Times Rich List, I discovered most of the people on it, tax was voluntary. And most of the money was in the tax havens.
Didn't you, I mean, remember you saying a long time ago, this is, and maybe you can correct me if I'm wrong, you did a headline for the Times, which they put on the front page, saying the rich pay no tax.
Correct.
How do they manage to do this?
Sometimes you have a bit of luck. They had no other story. It was one of these bad news weeks. And this one of mine was actually 5 months old. But it was carefully framed, and News International interfered. I had got a figure of $25 billion from Price Waterhouse, and the managers in News International cut that down to $1 billion, arbitrarily.
Talking of the crooked auditors, former KPMG executive has been charged with conspiracy. Six accountants were accused of arranging to obtain and misuse confidential information about the regulator's plan to inspect audits. So KPMG seem to be spending quite a lot of their time. This is in the States, by the way, not over here. Quite a lot of the time kind of spying on the regulators, this sort of thing. But they're actually a very powerful. They were involved, for example, in signing off the accounts of Carillion last year. Thank you.
Yeah, and that certainly needs investigating, doesn't it? But I mean, all the things we've talked about here, and including what Kevin's just said, I think points to the fact that I think most people really feel that capitalism isn't working for them. And that doesn't mean necessarily that we ditch the whole thing, but it does mean that it needs to work in a different way. And I think even really good capitalists, devoted capitalists, know that if you want a really good society to live in, there's no point having loads of money if you've got lawlessness, crime and no health service outside. You actually need the schools to work, you need the roads to be good, you need the train service to be good. Everybody needs all of those things to work, even if it's just so other people can get around. So we do need to look at capitalism in a different way. I would like it to be a well-regulated mixed market so that we've got a mixture of publicly owned social housing and utilities, but also that people who are working in the private sector, which is most people after all, feel they're getting a fair day's pay for a fair day's work, that they've got a future, they can support their families, that they're not living in a situation like we've got so much in Bristol at the moment, where housing is so expensive they can't support themselves. That's what's underneath or behind stories like the one about KPMG, is capitalism not working.
Can I come in? When the Sunday Times Rich List started, it was quite interesting. I had a look around. There were endless studies by academics of the poor, but no studies of the rich. And the Sunday Times editor was quite conscious of the fact that the best way to go about doing something about excessive and unfair wealth was to publish a list. But no academics have taken it up properly. It's still academic studies are still targeted on the poor. They're not targeted on the rich, where the money is.
That is a very good point, Kevin. That is a really good point.
You should be on question time. Anyway, Kevin, another story which is not related to any of those, but it's more to do with Finsbury Park violence. This is a trial that's going on at the moment about this guy from Wales, I think he was, that drove into the mosque crowd in Finsbury Park. This is from The Independent. Messages sent by Tommy Robinson to the terror suspect Darren Osborne are revealed in court this week. Updates from Woolwich Crown Court are being reported here by Lizzie Dearden at The Independent. Darren Osborne is in court for the second day of his trial. That is actually earlier this week. That was Tuesday. Tommy Robinson, who is the founder of the English Defence League, apparently reformed, and also Britain First's Deputy Director Jaya Franson, actually sent this suspect messages days before the attack, the court has heard. This is pretty shocking, isn't it? It just sounds to me like potentially incitement here and some sort of direct connection between these far-right groups and this guy who, by the way, I was reading recently, he had been pleading to be put into a mental home because he was having all sorts of trouble, mental troubles, basically. He's basically a bit of a nutcase. Sorry to say this, folks, but he wasn't getting any care. And what was happening was Tommy Robinson and Jeff Frieden were basically feeding on his difficulties.
They're exploiting him, but that's what extremists and racists do. They exploit vulnerable people and they manipulate and they lie and they use language to convince people that hatred is the right way. But also, I think this isn't just about vulnerable people. Let's not forget that the President of the United States retweeted Britain First and he's just about worked out that maybe he ought to apologise, though I don't think as yet he has actually apologised. But really, if you don't want to give racists a platform, don't retweet racists.
What do you think about his... he keeps using this phrase, fake news, doesn't he? He says that Robert Mueller, who's investigating him over Russiagate, is saying that Trump tried to get him removed and that's fake news. I mean, what is fake news and what isn't? Because I noticed this week Theresa May has just set up a whole new unit at the Cabinet Office to try and stop fake news from getting out. Is this just a sort of silly buzzword of the year or is there anything to it, thank you?
I think there are things that are knocking around on social media that are, quite frankly, just made up. And you would expect that, given the fact that sort of democratisation of the media.
What about on the BBC?
But, you know, are
these things knocking around on the BBC?
Well, I'm not aware of them, but I'm aware of...
Okay, what about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq? That seems to me like it might have been fake news.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
At the moment, we're in the middle, and you're too young to remember this, but there was a Cold War once, and the propaganda was terrible, and we're back in the middle of it again. We've now got an anti-Russian thing, you know. Most of it is fake news.
Time now for the Murdoch news. Of course it's not fake news. Of course it wouldn't be, folks. At 6 o'clock, thanks to our guest MP for Bristol West Thangham, Debonair.
You. This is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.